Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are returning to, ultimately we're returning to Stand for Truth. That's where we're going. We've often covered it. We've often talked about it, but we're going to cover it in a different way today. So it's something interesting, and I'm actually excited to have the conversation because, as I said before we started recording, kind of made me a little bit uncomfortable, and I think that's a good thing. Speaking of people who make me uncomfortable, Martin.
Yeah, that's my job, to make you uncomfortable, Tony. Just want to remind folks, look, we can't keep doing this unless you join up as patrons. We just can't. We are struggling. I need this. You know, I'm doing a lot of work to get the old bogus self-employment thing sorted out. So I need the support of the Tortoise Shack to do that. So stick your hand in your pocket, patreon.com/tortoiseshack.
I do want to give a shout out to the work the guys did over the last few days in terms of across the shack. I would recommend go to tortoiseshack.ie. Of course, I would check out all of the podcasts and some of the unbelievable content we put out over International Women's Day. I think we did 6 panels in total. I'd say for a little independent podcast with no ads and no sponsors, we did pretty good. Are we doing enough? Probably not. But there's more we can do. There's more we can learn.
From the very start, and I've said this before, Tony worked very hard to make sure that we had some sort of balance within the podcast. That included gender balance. And at the start, it was work, but now it comes very naturally. It just happens. And that's the way to do it, so that it just happens naturally. You don't have to worry about it. It's already in your head.
And to go back on, just in terms of the actual look, there as when I go back to it and say there are no ads, no sponsors, it is purely listener led. And Martin is right; it's very vulnerable. It's not really if an accountant arrived in, they say, Tony, it's not a viable business, and yeah, that's what. And that's fine insofar as it goes, but we do need people. Like if there's literally 23,000 people listening in a 24-hour cycle, well, surely some of you are getting something from it. You're coming back and you're listening again. It's the price of a cup of coffee. It makes all the difference to us. It is really the difference maker. Anyway, enough of that. As I said at the outset, we're coming back to Stand for Truth, and we are joined by Anne-Marie Kelly, who is a singer, artist, filmmaker, a working psychotherapist, and she has made a 20-minute gut punch of a movie called God-Given Opportunity that throws you off balance from the outset. And first of all, just Anne-Marie, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to promote the film.
Sorry. Just before we start, can I ask, I've just given what I can only describe as a really wide, but myself and Martin, we talk about imposter syndrome. But what a CV already. And the actual filmmaking idea, is this just something that is this your passion, is it?
Well, it is. It's kind of bringing together, like it sounds like separate kind of roles or occupations, but they actually all come together very nicely in the filmmaking world. The acting and the film I got into to kind of help me with my singing career, which it has been going on a long time. But within the world of psychotherapy that I work, you know, I was listening to your other podcast and about people talking about what therapy does for them and how that opens up their truth and gives them room to talk about that. So the filmmaking that I kind of work in, it's very much about representing a truth, maybe a hidden truth or a hidden grief, that type of thing. So it's all the paths have kind of brought me into filmmaking, really, just to make a point or to express what I'm hearing through that artistic lens. I think film and music can speak to people in a different way than just actually talking through something. I think when it hits people on an emotional level, I think you make your point, you know, in a more lasting, impactful way.
And I'll come straight to the film. In that you do have a great mix of film and music, and the choice of music for the first couple of minutes in the film is very important. It sets a scene. A very important choice of music, and if you don't mind me saying, the song is Big Rock County Big Rock Candy Mountain, which is an old song. But it's also the song itself is a story of going to somewhere where there's salvation, where things will be okay, where the life you live, the really difficult life you live, is no longer. And it kind of sets the tone for what's about to come. Was that intentional?
It was intentional. And the whole thing is to kind of bring the viewer in, to bring us into this man's journey, to let us fall kind of into him and to start to love him. And also that song was taught to me. We lived in a very Father Ted-esque kind of era. And we would have had friends who were priests, you know. So I also wanted to represent that experience too. So that song was taught to me by this Scottish priest who was, unlike what we hear about in the media, was a really nice, decent, kind man. So for that experience, I wanted to include that song in to have the two worlds kind of existing in the film, the good that was in the church, and then to bring us into the bad. So yeah, so it was very deliberate. And even the way we represent it in the sound, I wanted it to sound like she's almost walking behind him, that she's around him, that he could be singing it almost himself. So it's part of the soundscape. The soundscape, we worked with kind of having almost sounds in that you're not even aware that you're hearing, so that they evoke that kind of emotional response that you don't even know you're giving. Mm. You know, so the sound was hugely important. Johnny Kelleher, I've worked with for many years, and he works in composition, and he's a fantastic musician, but he's big into that subtle soundscape that, you know, would make you be crying, and you wouldn't even know why you are. You don't know what's got into you, but he's master of that. So, yeah, that was very deliberate.
I'm just going to go back a step. And when I say stand for truth, this is where it was framed at the outset, that in 79, over 1 million people went to the Papal Cross in the Phoenix Park to watch the Pope say Mass. And then I think it was David O'Doherty said on one thing, he said, and when he came back, I think he played upstairs in the International Bar. which is one of my favorite lines. But it's nonetheless, I think it showed it all. So that's the context of the actual piece. But it also tells you, you think you're going to see one thing and you don't.
So
I don't, without spoiling it for anyone, because it is 20 minutes and you should go and sit through it. Do you want to just give the idea behind the story?
Yeah. Well, it's bookended, and I have actually started to spoil it a little bit in the telling, because I don't want anyone to be expecting to be entertained and then get kicked in the guts, because it's not entertainment at all. It is that art to evoke. But it's bookended with the Papal Cross to show you this is the context that we're telling the story in. And then it becomes more fable-like, more parable-like. So, you know, using, I suppose, whether you believe in Jesus or not, he was a great storyteller. And he could certainly bring it down to the important facts. So it's kind of using that method of telling the story, getting rid of all the crap around it and just telling the bare facts of what happened. There was a great ideal. There was, an aspiration, if you like, of this place where people will be loved and be cared for. And then how that was infiltrated by kind of people being naive and letting somebody with evil intent in.
That comes across very clearly. Did you work hard on character selection, on the people who were going to play the parts?
Well, for the character of Dermot, and again, it's a name from, you know, Irish folklore, you know, that will be associated with love, but when I was writing his character, I had worked with Jamie McLean on a couple of other projects before, and he's a fantastic actor. He can make you fall in love with him, and he can make you want to punch him in the face. He's brilliant at kind of going through that arc. So when I was writing that character, it was his face I was seeing in the role all the time. Now, when it came to... Sorry, go on.
Sorry, go ahead, Anne-Marie.
Yeah, no, then when it came to the character who was going to play, if you like, the Jesus figure or the church figure, I was more open on that. And I had kind of a different idea in mind. But then when Dimitri came into the casting, he's a very cinematic man. You know, he commands the room. He has that. Now, he had very much an idea on how he wants to play the character. And he embodied that. Like, he's playing two roles, really. He is playing, if you like, that loving role, that Jesus role, but then he's also playing the arrogance of the church, and that this is my idea. And he can do that, you know, he can almost have a haughtiness to him. And then he can have the anger and the passion as well. So he, when he came in for the part, I just thought, oh, I have to have him.
Yeah, I would have looked at him and thought, Jesus Christ, superstar. I think he just fits the role absolutely perfectly.
It reminds me of a young me.
I thought you looked familiar. Yeah, like, oh, that's what it is. Well,
if I was blonde and handsome and had a
red Jesus.
Yeah.
But he fits the part very well.
He's very charismatic,
And then there's the relationship between the two characters, and you developed that very well, and that was developed very well. And without giving too much away, the switch is kind of very shocking.
Yeah, it's very sudden and shocking. But then a lot of people have watched it say to me, I had to watch it again. And when you watch it again, you see the clues are there. They're all there, the moments, the choices, the flickers across. And I wanted to very much portray Jamie's character as non-monster, as a man, you know, somebody with a conscience, somebody who does, you know, have different emotions, but that who chooses, who definitely makes a choice to pursue the behavior he does. So... yeah, it's the two of them then in the relationship they develop. I also wanted to give that almost a Dimitri's character is very preachy, but also then that almost like that you feel a little bit stoned with them, that, you know, that they're getting into this. It's almost hypnotic that he's falling into this lure that, yes, I can have this here with this man. And then he kind of, you see it kind of towards the end of it, he comes out of himself, but it's like, but you've done this, like, you know, you brought me in here, you gave me this opportunity. And then he also echoes that then later on. It's like, he doesn't even own his own behavior. He puts it back all the time onto the other character.
How the issue of trust was established, that was very visual. I don't want to give it away, but it was very, very visual, and it was very delicate, really, in how it was handled, and it was a real trust issue. Yeah. Did that idea come to you out of the blue? Where did you get that idea? Because it establishes a trust between the two characters very, very quickly, and you see it extremely quickly.
Yeah.
Did you plan it that way?
Yes, I did. Well, I suppose everything that comes out in the film is kind of all the questions that would have come over the years, and then particularly got just magnified hugely at that Standing for Truth rally. You know, the things people talked about, that what, and trust, of course, being a huge one, that I trusted this person. And then they, you know, that it wasn't this, you know, stranger coming in from the outside. It was somebody I had let in under my skin, and they then turned on me. So it is very deliberate. Now, somebody who looked at it said to me, sure, that would never happen. He gives him the tool straight away. He gives him access to hurt him straight away. But all those questions that you kind of go, that's silly, that wouldn't happen. When you turn that question then on the church, it's exactly what happened. It's like, yeah, come on in, you know, yeah, we won't fetch you, yeah. And if you do something wrong, we'll just move that aside, you know. So the questions that can be leveled at it, or the observations, they also belong and very deliberately belong at the door of the Catholic Church as well. So, yeah, it was very deliberate and also very symbolic, you know, like it's just symbolism all the way through to kind of keep hitting home that message of trust, of religion, of devotion, of... and blindness, blind faith.
And yeah, I want to go back to it again. You referenced the Stand for Truth rally, which took place at the same time as the Pope visit, who, as he was returned, well, not as as a different
mass, yeah,
for the mass. And so that was clearly the catalyst for this. But the actual genesis of the idea comes from our Ireland story of our relationship with the Catholic Church. Like in terms of Stand for Truth itself, in terms of the movement, like, were you there on the day, and was this the kind of thing that stayed with you? And that,
yeah, this is on the day, like we went to the Standing for Truth gathering. And I suppose, like, I would have been very young in the 70s, and I remembered that euphoria. It was like a rock concert, and every bus in Dublin was going to that. And then here we were all that time on as adults. And when Colm O'Gorman was talking about John Paul at the Mass in Knockna, I would have older siblings who would have been kind of very moved by that, you know, about him telling everybody that he loved them, and that, you know, the euphoria that generated. And I suppose when he talked about it then, and how his experience, fitted in or didn't fit in, if you like, to that story, that while John Paul was saying all those wonderful things and inspiring all the young people in Ireland, that he knew about the rapes that were happening in the Irish church, and that he was just carrying on regardless, and kind of in effect enabling this behaviour and these wrongs to be done. So I suppose, and there's a different thing happens, I think, when you're seeing somebody speak on the telly, it can be moving. When you're sitting in a room with someone, it's a different type of movement. It's their story. But then when you're hearing person after person tell their story, and they're so affected by their story and so emotional about their story, and then they're talking about the people who aren't there, the people who died from drug overdoses or for suicide because of what has happened in their life. So all those things. And then what I think was one of the most moving parts was when everybody walked in silence down to the mother and baby home. And it was the silence of it. It was the dignity of it and the waiting. So all those things, I suppose, just combined. And I just felt like a bit useless in all of that, that I had kind of grown up in one side of the church while the other side was in existence. And, you know, what could I do about it? So it was like just a bit of a soreness that hung around for a while. And then I suppose for me, making the film is a catharsis, because it was somewhere to put that hurt, you know, that of witnessing all that. So it was something to do with it. Yeah,
it's actually, to compare that to what the actual papal visit was like when it was John Paul, I was one of those small kids that went in, and there was four of us went in with my mother, and my dad stayed at home to mind my baby sister. And we weren't a particularly religious, you know, mass on a Sunday, but, you know, we weren't saying prayers over dinner or anything like that. We were just normal, I would have thought. But I remember that, and I remember thousands upon thousands of people walking in the dark, pretty much in silence, because, you know, you were walking through built up areas up to the Phoenix Park. And it's just something that, I mean, it was such a long time ago and I was so young, but it stayed with me, the amount of children. The amount of children that were in that. And like, I can't remember, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We were walking up towards the Phoenix Park, and just the sense of, I mean, there was a huge amount of the population of the country was doing the exact same thing.
Yes. We were everybody
walking there at the same time. And it was really only the older, the infirm who didn't make it there. Everybody else made it there. To then compare that with what you describe of how the hurt and the bitterness of people who were probably in that silent group marching towards the Phoenix Park, and yet years later, here they are trying to tell their stories about what happened to them. Do you think the movie gets it, conveys it?
I think it conveys the betrayal, and that's what what I'm aiming for with it is, and I don't know if I'll reach them, but it's the people who at the most recent visit were saying, oh, we hope, you know, there's no more negativity or, you know, the bad publicity. And it's like, hold on a second here. Look at what you're dismissing and just brushing aside. And for if people who feel that way, if they watch the film and they fall for this character, and then they get, because when he actually turns, you do get this, oh my God, you know, it's really hurtful. And that it's to feel the heart now. And then, and imagine that magnified beyond what we can imagine, because that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about somebody going, you know, going on about some ancient, you know, kind of small hurt. This is big damage that it does to people. It's evil all the way through, you know, and it goes on through people's lives. It can't be just dismissed as negativity. So I think that the film does that. It makes people feel really uncomfortable. It's kind of bleak as well, because at the end we just see the kids standing at the cross and they're still waiting, and they're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And it's like, please, will you let the credits come? Because I want.
Yeah,
this to be
yeah. I was waiting. I was waiting. I was like going. I'd have to tell listeners honestly. Mm. It was that moment where you look at the, because you're watching it on. I was watching on a tablet, and I'm going, will I hit the forward 15-second thing, or will I wait to see if I miss something?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of. So you're smiling now, but like I wasn't smiling.
No, I'm smiling. I'm smiling because that's what it's designed to do.
I understand. I'm just, you know, I was sitting there and I'm going, oh God, yeah, just hit the button.
Yeah.
Like, don't hit the button.
And you watch it in the morning. It's not a morning movie. It really isn't. It's like, oh God, well, that's not going to set you up for the day. No. It's designed.
I feel a bit kind of off today now after watching it.
Things
don't gel.
Yeah. It's relentless, and nobody wins in the end. It's left there waiting to be addressed. And again, that's exactly the way it is with the church. Like, it has not been atoned. Can it be? I don't know.
How do people find this movie, Anne-Marie? Because they need to find it and they need to watch it. How do they do it?
It's on Vimeo. I'm actually in the process of setting up a website specifically for it now, the more publicity it's getting. But it's on Vimeo, and can you guys link it in the,
of course, we can add, we can add the blurb, as long as you, with your consent, we can add it to.
Absolutely. I want as many people to see it as possible. It's not going to, with the way COVID has affected the film festival circuit, I don't believe it will reach the people I want it to reach through film festivals. And even through film festivals that happen in the flesh, they reach, you know, people who are really into film. I want to try and get beyond that. So what I'm hoping is that people who, you know, who like to push issues of truth, you know, the artists who do, that they might put it on their Twitter, feed it out to their followers, and let as many people see it as possible, in the hope that it might move people who maybe weren't moved before.
I think it was a brilliant film, Anne-Marie. I hope it gets the reaction it deserves, and it does. It, you know, you take something away from it, and it takes something away from you, which I think is more important.
Yeah.
I hope people do watch it. I can't say I enjoyed it, but I don't think that's the purpose.
You felt it.
It's not. Yes, I felt it. I certainly did feel it. So thank you so much for coming on here this morning and talking to us about it. It's a great piece of work, and it really does stand to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Do check it out, guys. We're going to now, we've got consent, so we'll have it in the blurb. You'll be able to click on the link and watch it. It's 20 minutes. I suppose all I'd say is don't turn away.
Watch it. Yeah. That's it. So thanks very much, guys.
Not at all. Talk to y'all soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on